Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. The story goes that in the year 860, the Chuds, the Slavs, the Krivichians, and the Ves, people who live in what we now know as Russia, had fallen out among themselves, needed somebody to rule them. So they turned to the Vikings. Our land is great and rich, they supposedly said, but there is no order in it. Come to rule and reign over us. And the person who accepted that offer was a man called Rurik, one of three brothers, Rurik, Sinias, and Truvor. Very close to Trevor, weirdly. Rurik.
you couldn't take a Viking chieftain. Seriously, Trevor. Called Trevor.
Rurik established himself in a place which we now know as Novgorod, and his successors later moved to Kiev. And it's from that story that the countries of Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine all trace their history. Tom, we did the origins of the Vikings in the East yesterday. Do you think there's any truth to this story at all?
Well, I think the obvious parallel with this, if you are in Britain, is with the Dukes of Normandy, which likewise has a kind of almost mythic origin story. So
Rollo.
It's Rollo who is given this land by the Frankish king, and all kinds of myths surround this figure. I mean, he probably existed, but
he probably wasn't called Rollo, though, was he?
No.
Tom Shippey, in his book about the Vikings, calls him Ganga Rolf, which I think is a much better name.
Yes, and all kinds of, and so there are all kinds of stories about how he founds Normandy, and about how the original Normans are not just Vikings, but they're people from, you know, all kinds of different backgrounds, and he establishes this this duchy, and the question of whether, you know, William the Conqueror, the most famous of the Dukes of Normandy, is he a Viking? Is he French? You know, what is he exactly? I think that sheds a kind of really interesting light on the process of state formation in Novgorod, but even more particularly in Kiev. And obviously the background to this, as in the West, so in the East, it's about the way that the Vikings are moving into strange lands, establishing Viking polities that nevertheless take on the lineaments of the lands and the cultures and the peoples that they're settling among.
Well, that's a very controversial subject though, isn't it? Because how much that's the case is kind of has been bitterly contested by academics. How Viking are they? For those people who didn't listen to yesterday, I can't believe there's anybody who didn't listen to yesterday's podcast, but we did sort of first 100 years. So the Vikings have been Vikings is actually the wrong word, because they're not really
the Rus.
Yeah, the raiding, the Rus, as they
the rowers,
have been coming largely from Sweden down the rivers from the Baltic and establishing this trading network, which is going to start to take on, as Tom said, it's not just the lineaments of the culture around it, but the lineaments of a state. And how quickly it does that is again debatable. So the sort of origin story that's told is that which is very flattering, by the way, to the Scandinavian self-esteem. You could say it's a kind of slightly colonial story, is that the surrounding peoples are so shambolic and kind of disorganized and backward, they are falling out among themselves, and they have to ask the Vikings, the Rus, to come in and rule them. And there might be some element of truth in that, don't you think, Tom, that they might, you know, appeal to these armed guys in their trading posts to come and help them against a rival clan or a rival tribe, and that's how it starts, do you think?
Well, I think it's failing the kind of the brute process, by which I think pretty clearly what happens is that you as we said in the early episode, you know, these to begin with are trading ventures, and so you have to have transit posts, you have to have places where you can not just do deals, not just store things ready for when the rivers become navigable, but also to kind of pick up information. You know, you can't survive without that. And we drew the parallel yesterday with trading posts in, say, Canada in the 18th century. But it's pretty clear that before long, these transit posts become forts.
Yeah, wooden forts. Basically.
And once they've become forts, then you can do what the Vikings are doing in the West as well, which is basically to kind of set up protection rackets. So what's been a cartel becomes a kind of mafia-style operation.
Yeah.
And you're charging protection money. And if Rurik existed, And there is a kind of historically attested Rurik at around this time, I think, it attested in Scandinavia. But
yeah, that's right.
Whether it's the same
in
person
Sweden,
or not is debated. But if he existed, I think you could imagine him as the kind of the equivalent of a mafia boss. And then, you know, again, as happens in the West, Normandy being the obvious example, a kind of a protection racket becomes a state.
Well, so we know so little about Rurik. We know that he established himself in Novgorod, which we talked about yesterday. And there's a statue of him to this day.
And this is the second half of the 9th century.
Yeah, this is, was 860, I think it is. Is it? Yeah, about 860 to 862 are the dates given. So, by the way, we haven't really talked about sources. This is coming from an incredible source called the Russian Primary Chronicle, which is, as is so often the way, written
in the 12th century.
Yeah, exactly. Written at least 200, 300 years later by a monk called Nestor, I think. And, you know, is written in very different kind of political and cultural circumstances. So we, as with so much of early medieval history, we just don't know whether these are legends, whether there is a grain of truth in them, whether it's retrospective kind of legitimizing.
I think there must be a grain of truth, because I think that the idea of a kind of dynastic descent from Rurik becomes quite important. So, you know, if Rurik didn't exist, someone of the same name must have.
But yeah, well, someone of the same, but the whole thing, Rurik and two brothers, yeah, I mean,
maybe that not kind two
of,
brothers.
All that sort of stuff.
But there's clearly a dynasty establishes itself in Novgorod.
Yeah.
That will then expand.
Yeah, so there's two guys who are, it says in the Russian Primary Chronicle, two men who do not belong to Rurik's kin, but were boyars. That's the kind of Russian, they're basically captains. I don't know what the word is. They're not nobles. I mean, nobles is the wrong word, but they're sort of, they're members of the gang, would you say?
Soldiers, I guess, is what
mafia
knows.
Yeah. And they basically go off. They're called The Russian Primary Chronicle has them as Askold and Deer. And as with so many of these names, almost all the names we're talking about, they're Slavicized versions of originally Norse names, aren't they? Because I think they were Huskulda and Duri, with the original, my beautiful, absolutely impeccable old Norse pronunciation there, Tom. I hope you noticed. They go off down the Dnieper and they come to what the chronicle says is a city on a hill. Again, a little bit too kind of folktale stroke biblical, I think, for. But anyway, this place is Kiev, and it already exists, been set up by somebody called Ki, hence the
and
name.
Ev.
Yeah. And Askold and Deer supposedly settle in Kiev and say, this is a great place. I mean, obviously it's a good place because it's further down the river, or further towards Constantinople. So it kind of makes sense that they've established another fort stroke trading station that becomes their own little polity.
And so the question of whether Kiev is Viking, which, you know, Putin's been worrying about this, so it's a topical question. But again, would you think that maybe, you know, there'd be a parallel perhaps with York?
Jorvik.
You know, it's a pre-existing settlement, gets taken over by the Vikings, gets a Viking name, the Vikings rule it, and then they gradually get absorbed into the fabric of what, you know, returns to being an English city. That perhaps there's, the parallels are never exact, but there's something there.
Yeah.
Of what's happening in the East as well as the West.
Your parallel with Normandy was a really good one. I think to people at the time, sort of 9th, 10th century people, our attempts to fix labels on them would seem weird, wouldn't they? They would say, well, who cares? I mean, what's it to you? What ethnicity? The concept wouldn't make an enormous amount of sense to them. So the question of, you know, are they Slavs? Are they Scandinavian? Are they Russians, Ukrainians? I mean, in a sense, it's a very, very anachronistic question. I mean, what matters to them is who's got the weapons, the power, the money.
What they are is lads.
Yeah.
Absolute lads.
And they are, but I don't think they're Bullingdon lads, Tom. I think they're much more.
No, they're much more predatory and brutal. Because Askold and Deer, these pair of kind of Viking adventurers, the kin of Rurik, his descent, you know, his heirs, if they exist, they're moving in.
Yeah.
And they're like the kind of, you know, the bigger crime family moving in, and they take over Kiev, and Kiev opens up the access to the Black Sea, and beyond the Black Sea lies Miklagard, Constantinople.
Yeah, which we haven't talked about at all, which is enjoying it's a renaissance, isn't it? Are we not in the Macedonian Renaissance at this point, Tom?
So things are looking up. for the Byzantines.
Yeah. So they still think of themselves as Romans, don't they?
They do.
Still call themselves the Romaoi. They absolutely think we are Rome. We are and they have this massive city. They have tons of money. They're a very rich and sophisticated culture. And then one day in the year 860, they kind of look out of the window and these, as you said, these lads
in their ships
have turned up in their ships. And the patriarch, the Archbishop of Constantinople, a man called Photius, has written this famous description of this. He says, the Rus are an obscure nation, a nation of no account, a nation ranked among slaves, unknown, but which has won a name from their expedition against us. So basically, the shocking thing for the people of Constantinople is that these utter nobodies, who they regard as so far beneath them, turn up and besiege their city.
And they keep doing this, don't they? And they seem to have very good intelligence, because they invariably turn up when the imperial fleet is away.
Yeah, or the emperor's off campaigning against somebody else.
So, exactly. So the walls of Constantinople are a great wonder. They are impregnable. But there are obviously all kinds of churches and monasteries, you know, as in England, that are kind of lying exposed. And the Vikings have all kind of fun with them, don't they? They use monks as for archery practice.
Yeah,
and they nail hats on to the heads of priests and all kinds of badinage.
Very poor. So we have a question from, would you believe, Tom, we've got a question from Neville Chamberlain. Neville Chamberlain says, were there any attempts by the Vikings to take over Byzantium in the same way they tried with England and Ireland? Neville, of course, his reaction would no doubt be to appease
a faraway country
which we know nothing. And my answer to that would be, it's completely implausible they would ever take over Constantinople.
One of them, isn't there, who nails his shield to the gates of Constantinople as a kind of gesture of contempt, because he obviously sees the walls as a kind of cheat.
Yeah.
But he knows that they're never going to break in.
I mean, it's like saying, you know, will Paraguay ever defeat the United States and conquer its territory? I mean, it's just not a plausible matchup.
Miklagard, the great city, it's Constantinople comes to kind of shimmer in the imaginings of all the Vikings so much that essentially the Asgard, the city of the gods, comes to be equated with it.
Yeah.
So that when they imagine what Odin's halls look like, they imagine it looking very like the golden city of Caesar.
Don't they also, Tom, there are some people who think that when they talk about Asgard or they talk about Valhalla, that images of Hagia Sophia, the Church of the Holy Wisdom, this incredible building, the biggest building in the Western world, I guess, at this point.
Which we'll come to.
Yeah.
It plays an important part in this story.
The gold, the mosaics, that creates a lot of the images of, because the images that we have of Valhalla, of Asgard, are all come later, don't they? They're all centuries after this.
And seem to kind of echo Constantinople. And I think, exactly. I think the other difference, so there's no prospect of them capturing Constantinople. But I think also what the Byzantine Empire can exert, which England or Ireland or even the Frankish Empire can't do, is to kind of generate this incredible cultural cringe. Because they, you know, every so often they're allowed, you know, they it's actually with Constantine VII, isn't it, who we mentioned in the previous episode, the emperor who describes this, the rapids that the Rus have to negotiate. And he kind of concludes a treaty that specifies, you know, where they, what they can trade, when they can trade, how they have to behave when they come. And they're kind of bringing in their walrus tusks and their narwhal tusks and their amber and their beeswax and all kinds of stuff. And they're also providing for what becomes very famous, a guard of what are called Varangians.
Yeah.
And the Varangian, a var is a vow. It's kind of,
The oath takers, would that be?
The oath takers. And so they come to provide the emperor with his guard. And so the links, essentially, the Kievan Rus start to be absorbed into the kind of the cultural tractor beam of Byzantine culture.
Well, that's where I would say, Tom, I'm sure you, I don't think this is a controversial view at all. That's the point at which they stop being the Scandinavians who are known as the Rus, and they start becoming the ancestors of
Russians, Ukraine and Russia.
Brought into the world of orthodoxy, of Byzantine church architecture, of all those kind of, they're beginning to kind of contract marriage alliances and trade deals and all this sort of stuff. And that brings them, you know, what do they care about what's going on in Norway? I mean,
yeah. And so by the mid 10th century, you get the first ruler of Kiev. I'm going to have a go at this, Sviatoslav. So he's the first ruler to have
a Slavic name.
But before him, you've had various rulers who have more obviously Norse names. So we had Asgold and Deer with the guys who'd seized Kiev. But then that gets seized from them by a guy called Oleg.
That's right.
Who is the guardian of Rurik's son, Igor, supposedly.
So Rurik is definitely Scandinavian. And Oleg is also definitely Scandinavian, because Oleg, which we always think of as a Russian name, is actually Helgi, I think.
Yeah.
Just like Olga is Helga. So Helgi, or as we call him, Oleg, he's the guardian. That's right. He's the guardian of Igor. And Oleg is a very impressive man, generally. He takes over Kiev. He seizes it from Asgold and Deer. He leads another siege of Constantinople and gets a ton of money from sort of Dane. So this is your parallel with the West, actually. He gets basically Danegeld from the sort of Byzantine authorities in 904. But he has they have very good deaths, the Grand Princes of Kiev. So he has a very interesting death. He's been told, Oleg, that his favorite horse will be the cause of his death. So do you know what Oleg does, Tom?
Tell me.
He sends the horse away. He says, you know, I don't want to kill it, but because it's my favorite horse, but send it away and look after it, and I'll never have any dealings with it again. And after 4 years, in the year 914, he goes to visit the horse. And because he misses it so badly, it's so sad. He goes to visit the horse at the stables, and he's told by the stable hands, well, the horse is dead. And he says, ha, 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 you know,
cheated fate.
Those astrologers were absolute muppets. You know, I've cheated death, exactly. And he says, bring to show my contempt for these soothsayers, bring me the skull of the horse. So they bring him the horse's skull, and he stamps on it. He said, he's shouting, the horse is dead, but I am still alive. I was supposed to receive my death from this skull. And he stamps on the horse's skull. And at that point, a snake crawls out from the horse's skull, bites him, and he dies.
There you go.
So the very act of defying the prophecy is what kills him.
But,
yeah.
So he was guardian for Igor.
Yeah, so Igor then is, so Igor, then takes over.
Igor has an even better death.
He has a very unfortunate death, doesn't he?
So Igor is the guy who negotiates the treaty with Constantine VII.
Because he's attacked them and been seen off with Greek fire, hasn't he?
Yes,
is that
why
they first used Greek fire?
Yeah.
Which is what? Which is
he does besiege Constantinople. He doesn't just attack, you know, with ships. He actually tries to take the city twice.
Yeah.
And he basically, he's a very, very kind of expansionist guy. So he's also it's in his reign that they all go off and plunder all the kind of Muslim cities on the Caspian Sea.
Oh yes, that's right. They go to Azerbaijan, don't they?
Go to Azerbaijan. So he's all over the place. I mean, he's very keen on kicking sand in people's face.
Yeah.
And one of the people that he kicks sand in the face of is a people called the Drevlians.
Yeah.
Or a Slavic people, and they capture him. They pull down two birch trees, and they tie him to the ends of these two trees, and then they let the two birch trees go. So he goes, whang, and he gets split in two, and that's the end of him.
Gosh.
However, this is not a sensible thing to have done.
It's now, probably not true,
coming
actually,
Dominic.
It's not true, that story.
Dominic, now center stage comes possibly the most interesting of all the rulers of Kiev, who is the wife of Igor and the mother of Sviatoslav, as he'll become. He will, you know, become this ruler. But she is ruling as regent, Olga, Helga.
Yeah, she's very. You've got a bit of a torn dress for Olga, I think.
I really have. She's kind of the Æthelflæd of the East.
But she's much more.
She's very robust in her approach to the Drevlians.
Yeah. So they're basically they're Slavs, aren't they? They're the tree people, because Drevo is tree in Russian.
So presumably that's where the story of the
trees comes.
The birch trees.
But also apparently the chronicler was ripping off
Theseus.
Yeah, Diodorus or some Greek.
Yeah, it is. It's yes. Yeah. But But who
so
cares?
Like a lot of these stories, like basically everything in this podcast possibly didn't happen.
So the Drevlians are obviously a bit nervous whether, you know, Olga is going to be, you know, what's her reaction going to be? So they send an embassy to her, and she puts them on a ship and buries them alive.
Yeah. Well, you know what? They send the embassy saying, would you like to marry our leader, Prince Mal? which is an extraordinary thing to do, the way they've treated her previous husband. Yeah,
foolish.
She buries them alive, doesn't she? Throws
on
them
a ship.
In a pit.
So a bit like we had Ibn Fadlan's account of the ship burial.
Yeah.
She seems to have done that, but they were alive. I think she kind of taunts them as the soil is being flung.
But then
over
that's
them.
Just the first of, because she,
yes,
she
it is.
She has three revenges, doesn't she?
So another, they then send another embassy, because the first embassy hasn't returned.
Yeah.
I mean, so stupid.
What happened to those guys? We'll send another embassy.
Let's send another one. So Olga burns them alive.
That's right, in the bathhouse. She says, go and have a wash.
Yeah.
And sets them
so obviously
fire.
Their standards of hygiene have improved by this point.
Yeah, clearly.
And then she goes and besieges the city where Igor was killed. And the story is that she besieges them for a year. And finally, she accepts that she's not going to capture it. So she negotiates a treaty with them and demands a kind of, a very small tribute just as a kind of sign of their submission. And she demands three sparrows and, Dominic, three pigeons. And you've been mocking the idea that we're going to be doing a podcast on pigeons. But this is a kind of interesting example of how pigeons have played an important role in world history.
I think you're underestimating the number of sparrows she asks for. I think she asks for three sparrows from each household.
Yeah, so each household have to give her a tribute.
Not from the city, generally.
No, yes. So each household has to give a tribute of three sparrows and three pigeons. And they do this, and she then sets them on fire. They dive bomb the city. It bursts into flames. She bursts in and kills everybody.
It's a great story. Do you think that happened, Dom? I mean, do you think that's a plausible...
well, there's a story that this happened in during the war of Simon de Montfort against Henry III.
The whole sparrow carry on again.
There was a cock.
Right.
That they set fire to London.
With
a burning cock.
I think, obviously, this is all from the Russian Primary Chronicle, isn't it? So, which I think is so clearly based on kind of previous models. But I think it's a good story, so let's not question it. Let's assume it definitely happened.
Okay, so Olga, robust in her approach to the murderers of her husband.
But also,
the
a
twist
saint.
Is...
A
yes.
saint.
Yes. So she... and it's, again, a sign of the growing influence of Byzantine culture and civilization that she converts to Christianity and gets the baptismal name of Helena, which was the name of the mother of Constantine, who'd founded Constantinople. Her son doesn't convert, but she's allowed to serve as a patron of Christianity in Kiev.
So she goes to Constantinople, does she, to talk to Constantine the VII, the guy who wrote the manual, Porphyrogenitus. There's some talk of them marrying, and they don't marry, but she converts and she comes back with a load of vases, it's said in the chronicle, which is nice.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because... And this is one of those things that kind of makes a mockery of our attempts to fix labels on these people, because she is, as you say, a Christian, but her son, Sviatoslav, he is still
a rampaging pagan.
A pagan. She has a Scandinavian name, Helga. He has a Slavic name. But there's no sense that this is a kind of contradiction or that this is some problem that needs to be resolved. It's just, you know, the sort of the flux and mess of how things are.
Yep. And he, like his dad, is a great conqueror, so he knocks out the Khazars.
Well, he's one of the first, he's the first of these people we have a physical description of, a genuine physical description made by, who is it? By one of the Byzantines, Leo the Deacon. He says he's a moderate height. He's got a snub nose. He's got a sort of bushy moustache and a shaved head. But a lock of hair that hangs down on one side.
That's right. Yes, kind of hanging down his side, isn't it?
He had an rather angry and savage appearance. You're
of
telling
course.
Me. He's got a gold earring with two pearls and a red gemstone. His clothing was white, no different from that of his companions, except in cleanliness. So he's well turned out, despite his savage appearance. And yeah, sorry, Tom, I interrupted you. He wipes the floor with the Khazars, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And is he the father of, well, Vladimir is Russian, Volodymyr, I gather, if you're Ukrainian.
Yeah. But again, a name that people think possibly has sort of Norse Germanic roots, and it could have been Valdemar, some kind of Norse name. But yeah, he attacks the Bulgars, he attacks the Khazars. I mean, you're saying that Igor was expansionist. Sviatoslav is very expansionist. Vladimir. He fights absolutely.
Vladimir.
Yeah. No, Sviatoslav.
Oh, yes, yes.
He's very expansionist, but he has an interesting death too, Tom. Now, none of them die safely quietly in their bed. You know what happens to him?
Tell me.
He has gone and attacked Constantinople again.
As you do.
As you do. I mean, presumably, I think they're attacking Constantinople to get better trade. They're like Lord Frost, who's obviously a listener to the show, and presumably listening to the show an awful lot now that he's left his...
got more time.
Brexit. I'm surprised I'm disappointed he hasn't been sending in more of those excellent Danish-themed questions. But yeah, they're presumably doing it to get tribute and to get, you know, money and better trade negotiations and stuff. But he's gone and attacked the Constantinople. It didn't really work out. He comes back and he ends up being ambushed at the rapids on the River Dnieper by our old friends, the Pechenegs. and do you know what they do to him?
No, tell me.
They cut his head off. They... plate it with gold, and they use it as a drinking vessel.
Oh, that's so predictable.
It's like that's early medieval Balkan.
They're always doing
formulaic behavior.
I think tying to a tree and, you know, ripping them in half is much more creative.
Okay, fair enough.
Even if it didn't happen.
Yeah, even if it didn't happen. So anyway, he has multiple sons. They all fight each other, and the winner is Well, it's interesting, actually, Tom, because almost every book on this calls him Vladimir, which is Russian.
But I've been told off by Ukrainians for calling him Vladimir.
Agreed. So if you look at Sergei Plokhy's book on the history of Ukraine, he calls him Volodymyr. Yeah. And it's a bit like we've talked about Kiev, you know, and in our minds, no doubt, because we're born in the 70s, that word is spelt K-I-E-V, not K-Y-I-V. So... at this point, we're getting more and more into the kind of territory where everything is contested between Russian and Ukrainian.
Yeah. But what isn't contested is the absolute key significance of his reign, because it's in his reign that the Ukrainians, the Rus, become Christian.
You call them Ukrainians?
The Rus. The Rus. Okay.
Please direct all your complaints to Tom Holland, not to me. Capel Loft,
the Rus, the Russians, the Ukrainians, whatever.
So, Tom, tell us, because his conversion to Christianity is a great tale in itself, isn't it?
Well, we've been talking about how so much of this material has a kind of folkloric dimension to it.
Yeah.
And in the previous episode, we talked about the Khazars, about how they can't decide whether to become Christian or Jewish or Muslim. And there's a very similar story told about Vladimir. He's in a world surrounded by worshippers of a single god. Which should he convert to?
Yeah.
And so he sends emissaries to the Muslim world, to the caliphate, and they report back and say, well, you'd have to give up drink. So that's an absolute no-no. And he sends them to the lands of the Franks, and they report back and say, yeah, it's all right, but cathedrals aren't great. And then he sends them to Constantinople, and they go to Hagia Sophia, the great cathedral, and they come back and they report in awed terms, we knew not whether we were in heaven or on earth, for on earth there is no such splendor or such beauty. We only know that God dwells there among men. We cannot forget that beauty. Yeah. And so this persuades Vladimir that he should go with Orthodox Christianity, the Christianity of Constantinople. Now, that story is obviously
completely true.
Not true.
Oh, Tom, don't say that. Because those are the most famous foundational lines.
I know.
At the center of kind of Russian, Belarusian.
But there are two obvious reasons why they're not true.
Go on.
The first is that they're very familiar with Constantinople.
Yeah, because
they don't need to send emissaries out to report back on what Hagia Sophia is like. They've been there. They know that. And the other is that this is very geopolitically determined.
Course. They're choosing a superpower, right?
They're choosing a superpower, yeah.
But Tom, I'm gutted that you missed out that they also went to visit the Bulgars on the Volga. And do you know what they said when they came back from the Volga? When we journeyed among the Bulgars, we beheld how they worship in their temple called a mosque while they stand ungirt. The Bulgar bows, sits down, looks hither and thither like one possessed. And there is no happiness among them, but instead only sorrow and a dreadful stench.
That's not...
You wouldn't choose that religion, would you?
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't go for that one.
Not the stench. Apologies to any, Bulgarians and Bulgars.
Bulgarian Muslims. Yeah. But you get, you know, I mean, the great incense in Hagia Sophia.
No so stench there.
Very beautiful.
So he's obviously choosing it as power politics, isn't he?
And the Byzantines are as well, because they offer Vladimir something that no barbarian leader has ever been offered before by Byzantine emperor. And that is marriage into the imperial family in the form of the emperor's, Basil II's sister, Anna.
Yeah, she's not happy, is she? She's not happy at all. She apparently is very cross about it. And there's some sort of breakdown in negotiations because he has to actually attack the Crimea in order to...
Well, that's where it all happens, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, so the Crimea, which is obviously very, you know, it's in the crosshairs of current politics. The Crimea matters to both Ukrainians and Russians today because it's where Vladimir is baptized and then marries Anna.
Yeah, and he has a weird thing where he has at the baptism he has all the old idols cast down and he ties. There's an idol of somebody called Perun, who was made of wood and had a golden moustache. And he's tied to a horse's tail and dragged down a hill. And then Vladimir gets 12 men to beat him with cudgels as a sort of sign, you know, I'm rejecting the old gods and embracing a new one. But it's also, I mean, obviously it's a two-way process, isn't it? Because, as you said, the Varangian guard, it's not Vladimir who sends the Varangian, the big contingent that become the Varangian guard to Constantinople.
Because that's part of the treaty with Basil.
Yeah,
yeah.
Basil will get what you would assume, wouldn't you, that they must have had Varangian mercenaries in their army before they had the official guard. That Harald Hardrada ends up being the commander.
So Harald Hardrada is I mean, in a way, he's the kind of the end of the story, the end point of the story, isn't he?
He is. Yeah.
We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk Harald Hardrada and really the end of the Viking Age.
Okay. Welcome back to The Rest is History. We are reaching the end of the Viking Age, which we've told entirely through a focus on the Vikings in the East. And the last and most famous Viking character, I think, certainly in England, to have been eastward bound is Harald Hardrada, who we know as the man who lost the Battle of Stamford Bridge, but had the most extraordinary life and career before that, didn't he, Tom?
He really did, and we've been focusing on the first part of this episode on the princes of Kiev, this kind of emergent Rus state. But all along, up in Scandinavia, you've still got kind of Viking adventurers who are treating these eastern lands as places that you can kind of retreat to if you need to.
Yeah, also places to make money, basically, and bring back tons of silver.
So Harald Sigurdsson, he's the brother of Olaf Sigurdsson, Olaf the Stout, who will become Saint Olaf, the patron saint of Norway. And he's briefly been king. He messes up. He gets killed supposedly martyred.
The battle called Stiklestad, which Harald is at, because Harald is a teenager, I think, at that battle, isn't he? He's about 15 or so.
Yeah.
And he has to go into exile. And he goes
to Novgorod.
And this is, Tom, actually, for those people who have found this all a bit sci-fi, because it's lots of weird names and stuff, their big antagonist is Canute, famous for attempting to turn back waves. Again, something that didn't happen.
Friend of the show.
An early faller in the Rest is History World Cup of
Kings.
Kings, but I think a very impressive king. I mean, a very formidable king, indeed. So king of a North Sea empire, he's basically taken over England after the end of Ethelred the Unready. He's married to Emma from Normandy. And he's
so it all
great,
connects.
He's everything connects. So he's the great antagonist that basically Harald Hardrada, young Harald Hardrada, is terrified of Canute. He flees and he ends up.
It is. I mean, it is a Western, isn't it? Or a mafia story or a science fiction story. I mean, you can see how the patterns of these stories, why it's such a kind of great setting for an epic.
It is. Absolutely.
He's been run out of town by the local cattle rustler.
Yeah. But as a boy, basically, as a teenager, he's got, such a stuff of a kind of children's story. He goes off down the river, like so many people have for, what is it now, 250 years.
Yeah.
And he ends up in Kiev, where the successor to Volodymyr, I think it is, Yaroslav the Wise.
Also known as the Lame.
Is now, he could be wise and lame, couldn't you?
He's lame to begin with, and then he's so wise that he gets promoted.
Right, that's good. So he's upwardly mobile.
He'd not beaten off his brother.
He's upwardly mobile, but not kind of mobile.
They'd had a kind of amazing war with his brother, fratricidal war, where they, they're fighting across ice-covered rivers and amazing.
Yeah.
The first great northern war.
That's very good. So, but Harald Hardrada wasn't in that war, was he?
No. So by this point, Yaroslav is the kind of the wise king.
And Hardrada, who's not yet Hardrada, he's just Harald Sigurdsson.
The young Harald.
So he pitches up and he becomes basically an enforcer for Yaroslav, doesn't he? He serves in his guard or whatever. And why does he end up going further down towards Constantinople, Tom?
Well, I think he is looking to get back to Norway.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate aim. Kiev's all very well. But the place where you're really going to make money is Constantinople.
Yeah,
so he's going down there with the aim of...
He needs cash.
He needs cash. Because when he... So he goes down there, he makes a tremendous success of it. And the epic, Snorri Sturluson, epic telling his adventures. He fights with dragons. He marries princesses. He goes to the Holy Land. He conquers Sicily.
But he genuinely does some of these things, doesn't he?
He really does.
He goes to Sicily with the Byzantine. I'm reading something here that says he's a marine. He's a marine in the Byzantine fleet with a man called Georgios Maniarchis. Do you know him? Is he a eunuch? No, he's the brother of a eunuch, isn't he? Or something like that.
Of course. Anyway,
everybody's the brother of a eunuch. Harald plays a great trick on Maniarchis when they're in Sicily. Do you know about this trick?
Remind me.
It's an excellent trick. So they're discussing who's going to get the best campsite for them and their part of the army. And they decide to draw lots. And Maniarchis marks his lot with a sort of a mark on it, or his thing, whatever they're using. And Harald says, well, can I have a look at your lot so that I can mark mine in a different way? And Maniarchis says, oh, yeah, of course. So they then put the both in a bag, and another man takes the lot out, and Harald takes it and he throws it in the sea. And he says, that was my lot. I've won. I get the best place for the
That was good fooling.
I haven't finished the story. He says, that was right. And Maniarchis says, how do I know that was yours? I mean, there's no way I can know that was yours. And Harald says, well, have a look in the bag. And Maniarchis looks in the bag and he takes out the lot and it's got his mark on it. He says, oh, it must have been yours. But of course, Harald made the same mark on his lot as was on Maniarchis'. The lesson of that story is that Maniarchis is an absolute idiot.
I think it's a lesson that Harald's an absolute japester.
Right.
Well, anyway. Great one for the prank.
Anyway, I mean, you're portraying him as a sort of Les Dawson figure, but actually...
Les Dawson?
And he's a prankster, isn't he? I mean, I don't know. He's a joker.
No, he's a great barrel.
Yeah, he's not a mother-in-law joke man.
No. So, no, he slapped you on the back.
But he...
So your teeth go flying out.
But he then gets drawn into... He goes back to... He goes all these campaigns, goes to the Holy Land, he goes to Bulgaria, all sorts of campaigns. He's very, very highly rated by the Byzantines. They make him a... Spatharo Candidatus. I'm very glad I read that out correctly. He's a Spatharo Candidatus, which is a very high rank for a foreigner. And he's been given a pay rise, and he's the commander of the palace guard and all this, that, and the other. And then he gets drawn into the power politics. Are you familiar with all these Michaels?
It's very, yes. I mean, it's almost impossible not to get drawn into it, isn't it? when you reach a certain level.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. So Michael IV is the emperor, I think. Well, he's married to the Empress Zoe, and they have all kinds of feuding. And at some point, basically, Harold is told by Zoe, get the guy who's been kicked out as emperor and gouge his eyes out, please. Mm-hmm. And he does. Mm. He personally, he can't trust his men to do it, so he gouges them out personally.
I mean, the sense you get of Harold is that he's very much the kind of guy who, you know, guy needs to have his eyes gouged out, he's going to do it.
Yeah, he's
hands-on.
And when an emperor dies, the tradition is that the Varangians get to strip the imperial palace of all its gold. So Harold does that. And Harold actually is there for so long, he gets to do that three times.
So he's, by the time he heads back, he's so rich.
He's incredibly rich. The Empress Zoe, who's in her 60s, quite fancies marrying him.
Yeah.
But she has a bad habit of murdering her husbands and gouging their eyes out.
Yeah.
So Harold is not keen on that.
And at some point, he's locked up in a dungeon with a dragon, I think.
Yeah, he is. He escapes. Yeah. He escapes from Constantinople. I mean, as with so much of this, you know, how much of this is true? A little bit, I think, with him, because we've got Byzantine sources. The stuff in the sagas, obviously, clearly quite, you know, the same people who worked on the sagas that worked on the TV series Vikings, basically.
The two things that are clearly true is that he comes back from Constantinople with a formidable fighting record.
Yeah.
You know, he is the hard rider, the hard ruler. And also that he's unbelievably rich.
Yeah. I'm conscious that we've told his story in a quite shambolic way.
Yeah,
but I think he's not the subject of this podcast. He's just an incidental character.
But he's the last of the Vikings, isn't he? So he's got this money basically so that he can then get together a large army and go and get back the throne of Norway, which is what he does.
Which is basically, in the long run, there's a lot of carry on with his brother. Is it Magnus, his half-brother? They split the kingdom and Magnus dies. And Harald becomes a very, very fierce and ruthless king of Norway, hence the name Hardrada, hard ruler. I mean, the only thing about that is, you know, is that a career peak? Because would you rather be the captain of the guard in Constantinople or the king of Norway?
I'd rather be king of Norway.
Would you?
Yeah. Because in Constantinople, you're surrounded by predatory empresses and
eunuchs
and, yeah,
but
dragons.
I think in Constantinople, the weather is better. The food's a hell of a lot better. There's more money. Everything is nicer.
No, but you're not. The whole thing is to have your own.
Yeah,
your own land.
Yeah, I suppose it is. You're right.
You have a slave's attitude to life. Whereas if you're,
who are you ventriloquizing there?
Harald Hardrada.
Okay.
I have the spirit of a Viking.
Right. I think Harald, you should.
You have the spirit of a eunuch.
Thanks. I'll remember that. I think Harald Hardrada.
Well, truth hurts.
I think.
Absolutely betrayed yourself.
Well, let's see what happens to Harald Hardrada, Tom.
Well, he dies, but it's, yeah. You know, hero's death. So that's the perfect thing, isn't it? That Harald Hardrada dies 1066, the year that basically, you know, traditionally it's the kind of the quietus of the Viking age, and he is a perfect figure to bring it to an end. Because he's a guy who dies in England, like so many Viking adventurers before him.
Yeah.
But he's made his name, he's made his money in the East.
Yeah. And also because his career kind of sums up all the... in some ways, he's quite a sort of out-of-time figure, isn't he? I mean, these places are becoming kingdoms.
Yeah.
You know, they are becoming more settled, slightly more ordered, I suppose. They are Christian now, rather than pagan.
And of course, with 1066, the Anglo-Saxon nobility go off and replace the Scandinavians as the Varangians.
They do. So the irony is that actually people who could have conceivably fought on opposite sides at the Battle of Stamford Bridge could well end up serving 5 years later the same army for the Emperor Constantinople.
I mean, I think that's that part of the fascination of this whole subject of the Vikings in the East is that sense of... oh, Vikings and Romans,
yeah.
It's kind of people out of time running up with one another, or Vikings, in the Caspian Sea. It does have that kind of slight element of fantasy about it.
Well, that's why, for example, Michael Crichton wrote a book called The Death Eaters or something like that. I can't remember. The Eaters of Light or The Eaters of something like that, about with Ibn Fadlan as a character. And that was later adapted for the cinema as The 13th Warrior, I think. And Rosemary Sutcliffe has written about it. And Henry Treece.
Henry Treece, yeah, The Road to Micklegard.
Exactly. You know, it's a permanent, it's exactly as you say, it's got a slight science fiction quality to it, in that it's Arabs, Romans, Vikings, all kind of...
All mixed up.
All mixed up, exactly. And I think that's one way, even now when we mention to people we could do this as a subject, you could see that people are kind of excited about it because... It's the ultimate exotic adventure story, I think.
Yeah, and as we said right at the beginning of the first episode, which seems a very long time ago, it's also very, very politically sensitive.
And yet, I mean, Tom, obviously there is no answer to that Russian-Ukrainian question with this. I mean, it obviously forms... It's the foundational moment of both countries' history books. There are statues of... these characters in Ukraine and in Russia, understandably.
There's a statue of Vladimir in London.
Is there?
Yeah.
Why?
Just down from Notting Hill.
Is it outside a church or something?
It must be something to do with that, yeah.
I mean, you can completely understand why they both lay claim. And obviously, I'm not going to, you know, be mad to sort of pick sides in this sort of, in the sort of political debate. We're not a political podcast, but they both clearly do. They do have different histories, Russia and Ukraine, but they come from the same place. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, right, we're just whittering now.
Great stuff. This has been a podcast devoted to people going to the sea, taking to the water, trading, stabbing each other in the back. And our next episode, by coincidence, is going to be on smuggling.
Perfect link, Tom. Well done.
So we will see you then.
Yeah, we'll see you for smugglers next time. Bye-bye.